investigating and reporting on government corruption and overreach, national security, national and international issues. You're listening to Scott Wheeler and Through the Looking Glass on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Hello and welcome to Through the Looking Glass. I'm Scott Wheeler on TNT Radio. Well, it's been another big news week. We're not going to be able to cover even a fraction of what's been taking place. But we're going to cover an issue that's been on the radar for a very long time. I have said and stated that it's been on been going on since 1992. And that is the dominant media culture having been corrupted substantially. It's always been corrupted, but became substantially corrupted in 1992 and since, leaving concerned Americans to seek information elsewhere. Many turn to alternative media sources, which provide unsubstantiated theories that pass as news. And people believe that it must be true because it's oftentimes the opposite of what the known deceivers are reporting. This has led to an American public that is uninformed, confused, bewildered, and left wondering, where do you go to get facts? We try to provide some of the facts here. That's the point of this broadcast. We try to bring evidence and support and substantiate what we have found. Now, to help us sort some of this out, the corrupt media and its influence on the American public and its contributions to the massive misinformed American public is Martin Seif. He's a Belfast Anglo-Irish Jewish journalist and historian, a defense industry editor for United Press International, and three-time Pulitzer Prize nominee for international affairs. He's also spent time at the Washington Times with my old friend Arno Dvorgrov, I'm sure you knew well, Fran Coombs, Wesley Pruden. Welcome, Mr. Seif. Thank you for joining us. Thanks for taking the time.
My great pleasure, Scott. I didn't realize we had such eminent friends in common.
Well, I actually was on the second floor for a while. I think you had left by then, but I was at Insight on the News for in 2002 to 2004. And I'd also would occasionally write for the Washington Times prior to that when I was a television correspondent, chief correspondent for American Investigator television magazine.
So you must have known Wes Pruden as well.
Knew Wes and Franny Coombs and
yes, of course,
Bob Morton, the whole gang. Paul Rodriguez was my editor at Insight.
A very dear friend. Of course, he's sadly gone now.
And very quickly, no one told me. Paul and I had been good friends before and even after when I went back in the Army in 04 and 05, we stayed friends. And I learned of his death somewhat months after it had occurred and was shocked. But he was a great editor. He was a journalist's editor and probably the best I've ever had, I would say, in terms of editorial supervision.
Yeah, he was a Willie Mays of journalism, Scott, because he was one of the finest investigative reporters, too, I've ever known.
That is absolutely true. And that's, I think, what made him a reporter's editor. He understood the confidentiality of sources, and he helped me improve as a journalist, and I've missed him and regret that I didn't get to see him before he passed. Anyway, today let's for one thing, one of the big issues that we confront constantly is the corruption of the mainstream media. I guess we'll call it that because of a lack, for a lack of a better word, I call it the dominant media culture. But just beginning in recent news, we had the president, Joe Biden, calling his political enemies, describing them as enemies of democracy. In the past, he's referred to them as enemies of the state. And how has the media treated this?
The media reaction is toothless. It is, in a way, predictable. It is, and again, you nailed it before by going back to 1992. One of the biggest problems in our media is conformity of thought. The media is now so centralized, so homogenized in terms of where people come from, into it from. And the old people think of, you know this, Scott, you came into an alternative Washington newsroom 20 years ago, which was really the end of the old culture. You still had people from diverse backgrounds who were coming into a newsroom, whether broadcast newsroom or print newsroom or online newsroom, same principle. And they came from different backgrounds of life, as you have done. They were skeptical in many ways. It's not like that anymore. And our mutual old friend Frank Coombs and I used to talk about this quite often. And that is, today everybody is Ivy League, everybody goes to Harvard and Yale, everybody goes to Columbia School for Journalism, comes into the Washington Post and the New York Times, having been conditioned in certain ways, and they all think alike, they all have the same areas of interest, they all have the same areas of arrogance and ignorance, and everybody thinks alike. And this is the fundamental source of the problem. Nobody is skeptical. Or nobody is allowed to have mainstream access who is skeptical.
That is precisely well put. No one who is skeptical is allowed access. And even in what we would consider conservative media, it is it's very well tightly controlled. When I say you go back to 92, that was the year. And it's going back quite a ways, 30 years. But in the 92 election, this perhaps the third biggest campaign issue was human rights in China. And that was Bill Clinton versus George H.W. Bush, of course. And Bill Clinton made human rights in China a significant issue of his foreign policy, referred to the butchers of Beijing. He accused H.W. Bush of coddling dictators from Baghdad to Beijing, that sort of rhetoric. And then immediately after taking office, he began decontrolling strategic weapons technology to communist China. They were pouring millions of dollars in illegal donations into his campaign. And the media, which had championed Clinton's human rights stance and for human rights in China, the future of Hong Kong, all of that, they immediately abandoned any scrutiny of Clinton at that time and his coddling of himself, coddling China. They immediately abandoned it and began defending him. It was striking at that moment.
I agree. I remember that era extremely well. And of course, another very interesting thing was going on in parallel to this, which expedited the process. And that was, in the 1990s, there was an enormous consolidation of the media, which was already heavily consolidated, the mainstream media. But there were enormous further number of acquisitions, mergers, buyouts. And even the most successful elements of the media, elements such as the Gannett Press or USA Today, managed to flourish by cutting down the size of news stories, the depth of analysis, and by homogenizing the news. Basically, they They McDonaldized the news for the whole country. In the last 30 years in America, and I think it must be the same in Australia too, there has been a reaction against homogenized fast food. It's bad for you. It causes heart disease, causes diabetes, expedites cancer. And so people, even when they buy Subway sandwiches, go for more quality stuff, and there's more diversity out there. In the media, the opposite process took place. We had the worst kind of fast food. McDonald's can look them in the face with pride. Their quality control is far superior to the quality control of NBC or CBS or ABC or CNN. Most of all, PBS. Most of all, PBS. The level of stupidity on PBS in America, if many of your folks have access to it and haven't watched it, you must watch it a little. Don't take my word for this. See it yourself. The level of closed-mindedness. Well, forgive me, I'm going off on one of my own favorite tangents here, but I think you get the idea very well.
You've actually made the point. We had multiple things happening at once. The media consolidation. You also had the media going from being traditionally liberal, which was one thing, to being an adjunct of the Democrat Party, and the Democrat Party is not liberal. It's progressive leftist, becoming rapidly fascist. But the media has now become their apparatchiks of the Democrat Party. They're no longer liberal. If they were liberal, you could at least argue with them. And they would hold the Democrat Party accountable if that were the case. But they're not liberal. They're apparatchiks. And therefore, the party gets to say whatever it wants. NBC News, for example, just today reporting that Florida Governor DeSantis and Texas Governor Abbott are creating magnets for immigrants to come across the border. So the mass influx of immigration across of illegal immigration across the border is being caused by two governors. And when you say the level of stupidity, that's what strikes me. Yes, it is so stupid that you wonder, is there anyone who can believe this with an IQ over 90? Does anybody look at this and see it? And PBS being absolutely one of the worst. And so you've seen this devolution of news media. Do you agree that it is also becoming more partisan? Feel free to disagree with any of my declarations by any means, but feel free to disagree. But do you see that same sort of mashup?
I probably sound more impressive to you and your audience if I did disagree, but unfortunately, I agree with you 100%. And it is bizarre and it is frightening. I'm a relatively old guy. I grew up in Britain in the 1960s when the media there, and at least compared to today in America, were much more open-minded. There was a great deal of bias and closed-mindedness, a very great deal. But it wasn't remotely as bad as it is now, and there was much more open debate and discussion, even on talk shows. There was less debate, but what debate there was much more open. That's the paradox of it. Today you have 24/7 talk shows that inform nobody, and there's no serious contradiction between people. I am old enough to remember that one of the great guarantees of press freedom, and I think you can go back, Thomas Jefferson talks about this, is the need not just for a technically free press, but for a diverse press or media where there are lots of voices out there. The kind of thing you folks at TNT Radio are doing right here and now. The kind of thing Rumble is doing. There have to be different voices. And now there are no different voices. And one of the paradoxes of this is the people who see through this are the people at the lower end of the socioeconomic block, the losers in society who are losing out, the people who work for government, who don't really have creative or productive jobs at all, who don't grow food, who don't work in what's left of manufacturing industry. who simply sign and countersign the forms and have a couple of meaningless degrees or supposedly meaningful degrees after their name. They swallow this the most. I see this in Washington, D.C. My wife and I have a couple of degrees each, but we are both in the first generation of our family to go to university. In our direct lines, our parents on both sides could never have dreamed of aspiring to go to university when they were young. And of course, our kids take it when have their first degrees and go through college, take it all for granted. It's a different world. But the paradox is something George Orwell predicted in 1984. Orwell said then it was the people who were the supposedly educated classes, the middle classes, the people who quote-unquote ran society, who swallowed all the lies happily. And it isn't just a political decision. It's a belief system. The Democratic Party is not a rational political party. You can probably say the same about the Republicans. We are talking about faith and belief systems. In America, we're particularly prone to this because our head of state is also the head of government. So the natural reverence and respect that always goes to the embodiment of the head of state, whether it's a monarch or a separately elected president who's a figurehead figure, in America, we combine that with the chief executive, the role that goes to the prime minister in Australia or in Canada or in Britain. And that means increasingly, especially when there is less criticism, there is a worshipful attitude, a worshipful attitude. One thing I'm looking forward to look at in Britain, and I'm curious about this, is Prince Charles, for different reasons, and I would say both good and bad, but he's certainly a man who believes in his own convictions, and they've been very clear on the environment and other issues, and I don't agree with many, if not most of them, but they're certainly his, but he's out of step with the liberal internationalist intelligentsia in Britain. And I think one can already see the murmurs being prepared. It's too early for them to go full hog yet, but to undermine him. Queen Elizabeth was a human hovercraft. She rode on a cushion of earth. She was untouchable. She was uncriticizable. Her son, unfortunately, is going to face the opposite situation and extreme entirely. And it will be interesting to see if the mainstream media in Britain turns on him. But what you said about Clinton, of course, is 100% true. Bill Clinton sold out the historic Democratic Party of President Franklin D. Roosevelt through John F. Kennedy. And for that matter, even of Lyndon Johnson, the party that supposedly defended the poor in society, working class in society, the rhetoric was still there, the welfare handouts were there. But I'm not a China basher. I believe provoking a war with China at the same time you're provoking a war with Russia is absolutely insane. But the American government, the Clinton administration, by joining the World Trade Organization, committed suicide, and all the 100,000 victims of fentanyl who take it in despair every year, all the unemployed, all the people who drink themselves to despair across the heartland of America every year are victims of Bill Clinton and the Democratic Party and their free trade policy of joining the WTO in 2000, which, as you said, is exactly the opposite of the policy he ran against 8 years before, and none of the liberal media, none of these geniuses ever called him out on it. And they can't, because they're incapable of doing so. If you talk with these people, they don't say, oh, you know, we must cover up by Bill Clinton, or we were threatened to do so, or we were told by our bosses to do so. They simply say, well, these are the only sensible, reasonable policies. And of course, we approve of them, and they make sense to us, and we were taught them at college. And therefore, any other policy must be evil and destroy society and cause war. And of course, they're generating the policies that cause war, and they're protecting the policies that cause war. Everything is the opposite of what the mainstream media in America says.
You know, you touch on a point. I think you've given them more credit than they deserve for thinking. I think it's more basic. They like being liked by who they consider to be the cool people in Washington. So they report that toe the party line. We're speaking with Martin Seif, veteran journalist and leading thought leader around the world. We're going to take a short time out. When we come back, we'll have some more pressing questions for Mr. Seif. Thank you for joining us. This is TNT Radio's Through the Looking Glass. I'm Scott Wheeler.
You should hear what Jesse Zirawell is talking about.
In addition to calling up 300,000 reservists, which does not include conscripts or university students, Putin has made some what could be described as inflammatory statements, if I can use that cliche, regarding the possible use of nuclear weapons.
In Russian language media, I mean, especially among hardliners, like people who really support the special operation, they're saying this is really, really bad because, first of all, territorial gains aside, what basically has happened is that Russia took control of territory, and then those Ukrainians who wanted to cooperate with Russia and consider themselves Russian, if the idea here was that Russia was going to go into Ukraine to protect ethnic Russians, to guarantee that, you know, Ukrainians can speak Russian and live in harmony and peace with Russia, the problem is that all these territories that Russia goes into, they're not guaranteeing that they're staying, you know? And sometimes, in some cases, they say like, oh yeah, we're here forever. And then, you know, a month later, they leave. How can you do this? It's so self-defeating, and it makes cooperation or welcoming the Russian military as liberty is impossible. It's like a death sentence.
Jesse Zirawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Google and Facebook, they don't sell you anything. They sell you.
Facebook constantly manipulates their users. They do it by the things that they insert into the news feeds, and they do it by the types of posts they allow their users to see.
It's what Google and Facebook are doing on a regular basis, by suppressing stories, by steering us towards other stories rather than the stories we're actually seeking. That's the real manipulation that's going on.
I was a design ethicist at Google, where I studied how do you ethically steer people's thoughts.
It will always favor one online music service over another and one candidate over another.
Google and Facebook has the power to undermine democracy without us knowing that democracy has been undermined.
There's what I call the creepy line, and the Google policy about a lot of these things is to get right up to the creepy line but not cross it.
Google crosses the creepy line every day.
Discover how society is manipulated by Google and Facebook. The creepy line at salemnow.com.
This is where you get your daily ration of high-velocity conversation. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Through the Looking Glass. I'm Scott Wheeler on TNT Radio. Joining me is the Oxford-disciplined Martin Seif, who is a veteran journalist. He has did his undergraduate and graduate work at Oxford University, so he is obviously a scholar. And we're discussing the media and the literal corruption of the media, which has driven the American public to look for information elsewhere. That is, the American public that knows they're being misled. They go look elsewhere. Oftentimes they're misled because the alternative media is not as sophisticated as the news actually is. And we've also discussed the utter stupidity that passes for news these days, almost like, you know, people are dumb, like they're talking to dumb people, and they think that the reporters think you'll believe this. And fast forwarding, we were talking about how the media changed in the early 1990s to become leaving the Democrat Party, abandoning liberalism and becoming Democrat Party apparatchiks. We saw this escalate in 2008 with Barack Obama and throughout the 8 years of Obama. And then in 2016, right up until Donald Trump secured the Republican nomination, he was receiving fairly decent media coverage, calling into MSNBC during the primaries. And then once he secured the Republican nomination, it was a bombshell. The media turned immediately and went after him, almost as though, it appeared to me anyway, that
the media was rooting for him to win the nomination because they thought Hillary Clinton would be able to beat him. I mean, it's the only rational approach you could take to it, not as a group, but individually, they were rooting for Hillary Clinton. Did you see it that way, Mr. Seif?
Scott, that's exactly, Martin, please. But that is exactly the way I saw it, completely. I mean, I was monitoring that campaign. I was working for European-based news agencies in Washington. And I covered all of Hillary Clinton's major campaign speeches, all of Trump's major campaign speeches. He worked far harder, incidentally, in the campaign than she did. He gave far more speeches, far longer ones, and they were infinitely better attended, which was also, incidentally, the case in his campaign against Joe Biden in 2020. But it was exactly the way you said. And this attitude actually originated with and came down straight from Hillary Clinton and John Podesta themselves, from the very height of the Democratic Party and the Democratic campaign. Hillary wanted to run against Donald Trump because she was convinced he was the softest and most vulnerable candidate. And of course, she got it, as she gets everything, completely wrong and upside down and back to front. We saw this in the Soviet Union. We see it now in America today. The most dangerous consequence of cutting off a free media, not just from the public, but from the policymakers themselves, is they have no biofeedback. They have no cybernetics. If you can't feel pain, you are going to die. If your nerves go dead. And this is what happens here. You're not getting reliable information back, and therefore you get everything back to front. So in imagining that you are isolating the public, ultimately the policymakers and the government and the top media people isolate themselves and get it back to front. In 2016, as you said, they wanted Trump to be the candidate because they were sure they could sweep him in a landslide. And of course, the opposite happened. He turned out to be the most formidable of the Republican candidates. None of the others were formidable at all. They were all for free trade. They all shared exactly the same basic catastrophic consensus that Clinton did.
It was kind of bizarre. Yeah, it was bizarre in a way because by picking Trump, they allowed Democrats to Clinton wasn't popular with Democrats, and they allowed a segment of the Democrats who didn't like her to see Trump as sort of an anti-Republican. They would never have voted for a Republican, but he sort of ran as the independent. He was running against the GOP establishment and against the Democrats. And there were a lot of Democrat crossover votes in that election for just that reason. They sort of teed him up as everybody in Washington hates him, and people who hate Washington said, so he must be good. I mean, to put it in simplistic terms, but go ahead, please.
No, please continue.
It was the whole thing has been the last 7 years, 6 years have been so perplexing to watch and to cover and to write about that. I'm wondering now, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, Martin, has the media and Democrats so defined Trump to the point where he is now unelectable, or is there a chance that he turns this on them again and becomes the nominee in 2024 and runs against Biden and defeats him? How do you see it happening?
It is certainly possible that he could defeat Biden in a free vote. The question is, will it be a free vote? The Biden administration has gone berserk in closing down any debate, open debate at all, on questioning whether the 2020 election was stolen. Now, what is extraordinary about this is presidential elections have been stolen from the popular vote in the United States for 200 years, since 1824. Not everyone, not most of them, But it has happened on several well-documented occasions. And on other occasions, it really has been very definitely too close to call. I can cite to you, if you would like, or if your audience would like, the specific occasions. But the first occasion was 1824, when the popular vote was overwhelmingly for Andrew Jackson. But John Quincy Adams was put in by the Electoral College, and the national uproar was so great that it led to the establishment of popular democracy, only for white males, of course, at that time, and not for white women, and not for any ethnic minority whatsoever worth the name, not Native Americans or Mexicans or African Americans or black people. Not at all in 1828, but at least for what right there. And by the way, the expansion of democracy led directly to the Civil War, which is another story. But the 1824 election was stolen. The 1876 election was stolen by the Republicans, and they sold out the South to the Democrats and to Jim Crow segregation for the next 80, 90 years. As the price they paid for the South accepting another Republican president in 1876. And this has happened on previous occasions since then. Richard Nixon was brought significant evidence by the FBI in 1960 that the election was stolen from him, not in the whole country, but specifically by Mayor Richard Daley for the Democrats in Chicago and by the Lyndon Johnson's machine, Democratic Party in Texas.
Absolutely. So yeah, the point is... The Daley machine in Chicago.
Exactly. But in the past, this could be openly discussed and debated in America. But the possibility that this could have happened with algorithms being used on voting machines only at the presidential level in 2020 is never discussed. And what is also never discussed is...
What's even more bizarre is right up until and including in October of 2020, PBS even was running, NPR rather, was talking about the vulnerability of the very voting machines in which they now defend and say you are a criminal, basically, if you think that they could be altered. The very voting machines, Dominion voting systems, were constantly being scrutinized by the media and by lefties in the months preceding the 2020 election, and now suddenly you are not allowed to question it. But I don't even bother to touch the voting machines. I look at the fact that three times as many mail-in ballots were counted in 2020 than ever before. And so to suggest right off the bat, to suggest that you can't question that election is bizarre and outrageous and undemocratic in itself. The fact that you can't point out, as I would, the media loves to go to Republicans and say, do you think the 2020 election was fair? The way I'd answer that question is to start with, for 4 years, the tens of billions of dollars in in-kind contributions to the Democrat Party and amplifying propaganda manufactured by the Democrats that Trump colluded with Russia, in itself made it an unfair election. That one thing, any Republican could make that statement and say, that was such an outrageous act of treachery by the media, you could argue that it was an unfair election on that basis alone.
Again, and I agree with you. I agree with you 100%, Scott. Absolutely.
So it doesn't even have to get into the actual vote. But the fact that there are Democrats questioning, and most people say they question the 2000 election and they question the 16 election. I pointed out they questioned the 1980 election. Nobody remembers the Gary Sick book, The October Surprise, that made some outlandish claim that Reagan and Bush rigged the 80 election by making a deal with the Ayatollah to hold the hostages. They brought that back again in 1988 when Bush was running for president. That 1992, they brought it back again. Of course, that was, he didn't win, but they claimed in 80 and 88 that they were illegitimate elections based on this bizarre claim about the act, they call it the October surprise. It was the original one. Then, of course, the 2000 election they claimed was false. The 2004 Kerry said was rigged. And on we go. And yet now the same media that has supported and even substantiated those ridiculous claims are now the same media saying it's insurrection if you question. And as Joe Biden says, it's undemocratic to question the 2020 election. I'm sorry, that's not a question. It's more of a meandering statement. But what do you say, Martin?
I'm glad you said all of it, Scott, because it saves me the embarrassment of saying it myself. So if they come after me, they'll be coming after you first. But again, I agree with you. And again, we have an Orwellian conclusion from this. You are perfectly free to say outlandish, absurd lies about the 1980 election, that it was Gary Sick's ridiculous claims for which no evidence whatsoever had ever emerged. The Iranians were not afraid of Jimmy Carter. They had contempt for him. They were genuinely afraid of Ronald Reagan, which was why they released the hostages. And it is as simple as that. You can shave with Occam's razor or you cannot. A good Oxford man in his day, 800 years ago, the true founder of modern scientific and philosophical and political logic. If the simplest explanation or hypothesis resolves the most number of problems, it is most likely to be true. Even then you have to test it, but it is most likely to be true. In other words, the application, as Thomas Paine said, of common sense. Same thing in 2016. We know when the Russiagate lie began. A drunken Hillary Clinton and John Podesta, while she was still reeling from shock in that Javits Center in Manhattan in New York City, came up with the idea off the top of her head. Let's blame it on the Russians. On election night when she still couldn't believe she'd lost. And from this tiny seed, the whole monstrous tree of growth or fungus grew. We know this. Now switch to the 2020 election. Forget conspiracy theories. Just look at the record we have in the votes. In the congressional races, you have an evenly divided America, which we still see today. A split America, no sweep whatsoever towards the Democrats, a seepage towards them because Trump's outlandish political style did alienate a significant number of people, but not at a landslide basis. This is not what is shown in either any the Senate races or any of the House races. They're all fought hard. Many of them are very close. The overall result in both the House and the Senate gives it to the Democrats, but by a whisker. By contrast, what do we see in the presidential race? We see a virtual landslide to Joe Biden of 7 million votes. But there is no evidence whatsoever for this beforehand. If you look when Biden appeared, he almost never appeared in public. And when he did, there were only a couple of thousand, 3,000 or 4,000 people there. All of Trump's events, and he was doing 3 or 4 events a night in the last weeks of the campaign. He thrives on those things, but he's at his best at them. There would be full audiences and stadiums of 25,000 people with another 25,000 people outside the stadiums watching and another a third set of 25,000 to 50,000 people that you could look online, recorded on YouTube itself. And I was watching on YouTube and I monitored all those figures at the time in all those races. And I testify that as a working reporter who saw this with my own eyes and verified those particular statements. And yet 7 million people come out of nowhere and vote for Biden. But then they disappear within 2 or 3 months of the election. Whenever there is a special election for either the House or the Senate, the Democrats either lose or they get in by the skin of their teeth. In other words, we are back to where we were before the election and in the congressional races. If all of a sudden Biden's supposed 7 million surplus across the nation, his landslide victory, has disappeared. There's an old 18th century English song, "Ask me no questions and I'll tell you no lies." That is the attitude of the Democratic Party, the Biden administration, and the mainstream media and PBS and CNN in the United States of America over the past 2 years. Ask us no questions and we'll tell you no lies.
Your Orwellian comparison is, I've thought myself, it's almost as though Orwell was seeing our day, or else the main, the ruling class in Washington, D.C. read 1984 and decided to emulate it, that it was like Plato's Republic, the instruction book for how to act and behave. It is such a strange situation. We're speaking with Martin Seif, leading thinker, scholar, and veteran journalist. We're going to take a short time out. When we come back, we'll have more on Through the Looking Glass on TNT Radio.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Well, what do you know? Finally, a so-called progressive who worked up the nerve to fire back, verbally, of course, at a member of the famed squad. He's 75-year-old Gerald Nadler, who's been representing New York in the Congress forever, and who recently beat another longtime Democrat House member, Carolyn Maloney, as two districts merged into one. This after Maloney called Nadler senile. He fired back after Michigan Democrat Rashida Tlaib announced, "I want you all to know that among progressives, it's become clear you cannot claim to hold progressive values yet back Israel's apartheid government." She said this during an online seminar. Nadler followed that with a tweet saying, "I fundamentally reject the notion that one cannot support Israel's right to exist as a Jewish and democratic state and be a progressive." Now, it may not seem like much, but it stands out in a Democrat Party that's been willing to stand by and let Israel be bashed and bashed over and over again, apparently out of fear of incurring the wrath of the squad members. Well, let's see how many more are willing to follow Nadler's brave lead. My prediction? Nobody. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg on TNT Radio.
Message is for Shauna, my mom, who just finished her high school diploma. I wanted to say I'm so proud of you for finishing school. You taught me it's never too late to achieve your dreams. I hope to make you as proud as you have made me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Finish your high school diploma for you and for them. Visit finishyourdiploma.org to find free and supportive adult education centers near you. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Freedom of speech, freedom of movement, freedom of choice, freedom of assembly, freedom of health. The voice of freedom is TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Through the Looking Glass. I'm Scott Wheeler on TNT Radio. Today we're speaking with Martin Seif. He's a veteran journalist, a scholar, a leading thinker, and has really brought a lot of clarity to a very, very murky world we're living in at the moment. And let me ask, Martin, let me ask you, what do you see happening? What is the future? Is the United States in massive decline? Are we going to see the end of America as we know it in the next 2 to 4 years? Or is there a way back, and what would that way back be?
Bless you, Scott. You could not have asked a better question. I've written a book on this. I had to publish it myself on Kindle. I'm still looking for a paperback or hardback publishers. Australia would be, in some respects, much better for me than the United States. If there's anyone out there, get back to me on it, because my answers are in that book, and it was published in 2015. To answer your question specifically and clearly, yes, America is in very serious decline. Yes, America could be totally destroyed in the next 2 years, as easily as that, because we are on the brink of thermonuclear war. But yes, there are ways back. And actually, the best news is we have been here before, because my 2015 book is a history of the United States from Thomas Jefferson to Barack Obama. And there is a reason I started with Jefferson and not with Ben Franklin or the Declaration of Independence or George Washington or John Adams. Because the political rhythms of American life, parties, faction, which are actually essential to preserve democracy and freedom, they are essential. They begin with Mr. Jefferson and the creation of the modern Democratic Party. They actually called it the Democratic Republican Party at first, back at the beginning of the 19th century. And I trace in that book, I document, there is not one America. There have been so far six different eras of America, with six different political and philosophical views, with six different defining presidents who set the tone. And I'll give you right now who those presidents were. And they were Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, of course, William McKinley, much more than Theodore Roosevelt. Everyone thinks of T.R. That's another story. I have a demolition job on T.R. and how he, if he had his way, he would have killed 2 million American boys needlessly in World War I, a virtually totally unknown story, but hugely important for the problems we face today. He was a warmonger who still lived in the romantic dreams of the 19th century. But after him came Franklin Roosevelt, defining president, and then came Ronald Reagan. Was Donald Trump a defining president? No, he was not. That's the interesting thing. Before each defining presidency, as the crisis spills, there is a precursor figure who points the way ahead, but fails to actually get there. And after he's defeated, 4 or 10 or 12 years later, his successor takes power. In Ronald Reagan's case, this was Barry Goldwater running in 1964. In Franklin Roosevelt's case, it was New York Governor Al Smith running in the 1928 election, when he was on the receiving end of the most extraordinary paranoid nonsense, accusing him of being a tool of the Spanish Inquisition and the Pope because he was a devout Irish Catholic. And he was a liberal for the day. And by today's day, he'd be very conservative. By those standards, he was a very left of center, enlightened liberal Democrat, and personally a very decent man. Very decent man. And before Abraham Lincoln, we all remember Lincoln, but we forget General John Fremont, who was the unsuccessful Republican candidate in 1856. Now, I predicted in my 2015 book, I never mentioned Trump by name in my 2015 book, but I predict that there are going to be two major insurgencies in coming years that will transform both the Republican and Democratic parties. And within a year, we had them. We had Bernie Sanders, who I have heard, I think there's significant evidence, again, that people turn away from, that he should have been the candidate in 2016. But of course, he didn't want to be the candidate. He was scared of it. Sanders is one of these people who draws a chalk circle around him and dances to the edge of the circle and says, oh, I'm going to jump out boldly. I'm going to jump out boldly. And he's a tease. He never, never does. He's the girl or the boy who always puts out and never delivers. He's a tease. He's a phony at the end of the day. But he did have genuine support going for him. And there is strong evidence that he knew that hundreds, and his people knew that hundreds of thousands of votes for Hillary Clinton in the primaries in 2016 were faked. It wasn't the 2016 presidential election that was stolen. It was the Democratic presidential nomination that should have gone to Bernie Sanders.
But, you know what's so funny is that in 2008, Hillary Clinton's campaign accused Barack Obama of the same thing, stealing the, especially in the state of Nevada. She claimed that Obama bussed in primary voters from other states to vote for him and help him defeat her in Nevada at a critical juncture in that election.
That is wonderful because, of course, on the one hand, Obama did that, but he broke no rules. He was playing within the law. He won both the nomination and the presidency that year in law-abiding, clear elections. If there's one thing I'll criticize and disagree with Barack Obama in many areas, but he is basically a well-meaning man. First point, very important. And second, very crucially, as much as anybody ever does, and nobody ever does fully, unlike Hillary Clinton, he almost always did play by the rules. And unlike Hillary Clinton, he loves to campaign, and he loved to campaign then. He had very poor, both Hillary and Joe Biden don't have good personal relations with Barack Obama. He doesn't think highly of either of them. And both of them could desperately have used him. And whoever the Democratic nominee is in 2024, if they get Obama on their side, maybe they still won't win. Maybe they will, but it will help a lot. But in my model and cycles of change, we are heading for a transformational election. The transformational president who sets the new era, the next Ronald Reagan, the next Franklin Roosevelt, we don't know yet who he's going to be. The two names I play with at the moment, it's very tentative, are Tulsi Gabbard, who is young, but who cuts outside regular rules and has been frozen out of the Democratic Party. She's been destroyed from the Democratic Party, but her positions are principled and courageous and consistent, and she reflects the view of an awful lot of people, of scores of millions of people who are outside and alienated from the political system. And the other person to watch at the moment, who sounds unlikely, and there are many people who dislike him for obvious reasons, but watch Governor DeSantis of Florida. Because he has Trumpism without Trump, which goes back to your very fine observation before, Scott, that President Trump always gloried in being the electrical third rail of politics. The more controversy and accusations, truthful and false alike, were thrown at him, the more he flourished on them. It's a paradoxical situation. Winston Churchill was like that. Franklin Roosevelt was like that. And Trump does have that quality. But he may now be so highly, so controversial, so toxic, that it may well be impossible for him to win next year, either the nomination or maybe if he wins the nomination, which I can still see, the presidency. We don't know. But if you look at DeSantis, and this is not good news for people who are genuinely liberals or for the Democratic Party, but DeSantis, I see some elements of the political cunning of Reagan, Dwight Eisenhower, and most of all, Franklin Roosevelt in him, in that he can both, as they say in Britain, ride with the hounds and run with the foxes. He is Trumpism without being Trump, without the Trump style. And that's been working very, very well for him with the Republican grassroots and in the politics of the state of Florida right now. So he's worth watching. So there is hope for transformation in America.
Well, let me ask you this about DeSantis, because I've watched him closely myself. Does he have the mettle, to actually fight the left and the media and the Democrat Party, or will they be able to ratchet up the attacks and just destroy him because he won't have a good response to their attack? I always felt like Trump blew his chance in 16 and 17 and 18 when he did not comport himself well on the Russia collusion stuff. I would have pointed out how Obama had colluded with Putin and Russia for 8 years, and there's no way that Putin would prefer him over Hillary Clinton. But he didn't do that. Instead, he tended to act guilty by saying Russia, 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 and this is a witch hunt, instead of going on offense and saying my opponent colluded with Russia, and you didn't say a word about it. And challenge the media to try and define explain this. We've got about a minute and a half left, Martin. Sorry to leave you with such short time. What do you think?
I'm in full agreement with you, Scott, and I think you've nailed it. I think again here, the key point here is the most successful presidential candidates. You have me on because I'm enthusiastic and I'm melodramatic, and that's good radio, but it's not good politics. In politics, if you keep your cool and get the other person to lose theirs, usually you've won. And Trump breaks those rules as he breaks so many rules, but he pays a huge price for it. Some years ago, my wife and elder daughter and I were watching a recap of the World at War episode, classic documentary on the US entering World War II in 1941. And it was basically the story of Franklin Roosevelt and his political genius. And our daughter, who was in her late teens at the time, made a very shrewd comment. And she said, I see why Roosevelt always won, because he was always laughing and relaxed and easygoing and good-natured, and he made his enemies so furious that they appeared threatening and ridiculous and absurd. She's right. They looked as if, they would shake themselves apart. Trump is the opposite of that. DeSantis has that quality.
We're all out of time. Martin Seif, thank you so much for joining us and for providing the wit and wisdom you've done for the past hour.